history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories just waiting to be told if we take the time to ask a few questions and listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, boy, do we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We're going to meet a gentleman today who is 99 years old. You'd never guess it by looking at him or shaking his hand. Frank Costa of Las Vegas, Nevada, originally from Geneva, New York, is our guest today. So, Frank, I got to hear about this. Growing up in upstate New York in the 20s and 30s with two brothers and a sister, your parents were both immigrants from Italy, is that right?
Correct.
So what was that childhood like?
Our life seemed to be around scouting. We did a lot of scouting in the small town. There was nothing else to do. But my parents had a grocery store in between scouting and the grocery store. We were camping someplace around the lake, Seneca Lake.
What a pretty part of the country, especially in the spring and fall.
It is a beautiful part. The three boys were all in scouting. I was an Eagle Scout. My brother was a Life Scout. Scouting was part of our life.
What did you get out of that?
I don't know. I guess it was always doing something. You're learning about the outside. You were going outside all the time. When I wasn't working in the store, I was out running a scout troop. And scouting to us was second to none, I guess. It's not like here. Back east, scouting is very strong. But here in Las Vegas, I don't find them. They have scout troops, but they're not like the troops we had.
Well, and the times have sure changed. That's 99 years is a long time to be alive, and I know you're looking forward to number 100 next year. You mentioned working in the store. How young were you when you started working in your folks' grocery store?
Wearing diapers.
Were you counting pennies or what?
No, she set me on the floor and said, put these over there, and I pick up the stuff and put them on the shelf. When we were growing up in the store. Then when I graduated from school, I bought a grocery store in the heart of town, and that was in 1937. And I stayed there until Uncle Sam called me. Then I turned over to my sister while I was gone, and she was running my dad's store, working with my dad. So then after the war was over, I came back, worked in the store with her, and then I said, I'm going to California. I says, the store is yours. I turned the store over to her, and I came to California, and I stayed here, which means I've been married for 69 years.
Yeah, you just lost your wife, Lena, a couple years ago, and of course it was a girl that brought you out west. But you never would have had a chance to meet that girl, or marry her anyway, if you didn't survive World War II. And I'm curious, too, being in that family grocery business during the Great Depression, I bet you witnessed some things that gave you a little perspective. What do you remember about those years in the 1930s when so many people faced hard times?
You don't notice the hard time as long as people work together. I used to have people come by the grocery store and say, can I have a bologna end? And if the guy asked you, and I'd say, just come on, cut a couple slices of bologna, you would give it to him, think nothing of it. Then you'd get another guy come in and says, hey, you got something you can give me? And you say, I'm sorry, the boss is gone. But most of the guys come in real nice. Most of them wanted a cigarette or a bologna end. They didn't ask for anything big. That's all they wanted. They go down the thing, and I asked one man, I said, why do you guys always pick up my store? Yet there's a grocery store next door, and the store's above me. He says, because when we come to the town, we mark who's good and who isn't. And that's why they come to your store.
They knew you had a generous heart.
They had it marked down on the sidewalk with chalk.
Wow.
And they would come in and be nice, and they got a piece of bologna.
I guess so.
Or a hot dog or whatever they wanted. And Dad always says, always feed somebody because he can starve to death. It might not be his fault.
Everyone that I've talked to who was alive during this time period seems to remember something about December 7th, 1941. So you were already out of school. You're working the grocery store. What do you remember about that day?
The college was having a party that night. They had been planning it. And they wanted a keg of beer, and they came over to order the beer, and they were supposed to pick it up that morning. They didn't pick it up. They came in and says, Hold the Bear, we're going to enlist.
Wow.
And a whole bunch of kids from Hawaii College enlisted in on that day. Cancel my order.
It affected business on December 7th. Did you have an idea at that point that it was going to affect your life or the lives of your brothers?
No, I had no idea. But I do remember my dad saying this. We were at the dinner table, and he says, "Boys, I want to say something. You have relatives in Italy, but you are an American, and we will probably be fighting Italy." And he says, "Forget them." He said, "This is your country."
Wow.
My dad told me that. So that was the thing I remembered at the table. And I didn't think anything more of it. I went along with my business. They drafted my brother in the first draft. He stayed the whole 5 years in Europe. That was in when the war broke out in 41. And in 42, my younger brother was going to get drafted, but he didn't want to be an Army, so he went enlisted in the Navy. And they deferred me because I had the business, and he couldn't take two in the same family at the same time. Then about 6 months later, they drafted me. And that's when I realized, hey, I'm in this. So my sister said, "I'll take over the store. When you come back, you can take it." Mm. He said, "Fine." So my dad says, between the three of us, as mother, dad, and sister, the three boys in the service now. Everybody said, "It's not fair. They're taking the cost of boys. They should leave one of them at home and all that stuff." And my dad said, "If they want the boys will go." Mm. So I went into service in April of 43.
Did you get a sense for how difficult that was on your parents and your sister to have all three of you gone and with your lives in danger?
You don't think of that at the time. You think, well, when am I going to get out?
Mm-hmm.
So my dad says, like he told us before, well, you do the best you can when you go anyplace.
You mentioned your father's statement about, we have relatives still in Italy, but you guys are Americans. A lot of people today don't realize that there was an effort by the government to keep Italian Americans away from that theater. And there were also camps where Italian Americans were sent, much like Japanese Americans on the West Coast. They were actually held prisoner by their government for a while. It's so unfathomable for us today. Were you aware of any of that at the time?
No.
Isn't that kind of crazy to think of?
Yeah.
But here your father made it very clear whose side you guys are on.
Yeah.
So you head to tank destroyer school.
No, first I went to quartermaster school because I had a grocery store. While I was there, they made me a warrant officer.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't buy being a warrant officer. As the old Army says, that's a bastard of the outfit. Me being a good little Italian boy, a good Catholic boy, when this is a bastard to me, that's not me. So I didn't want to, I said, I don't want to be a warrant officer. So they sent me to the tank destroyer school.
Uh-huh.
I graduated and they sent me to San Luis Obispo in January of 44. So they sent me to join the 81st Wildcats. And from there, we went to Fort Roberts, picked up our tanks, and then went to Marysville, California for our training session.
Mm-hmm.
From there, we went to Hawaii, and I became lifeguard on Waikiki Beach.
Tough job.
Well, the guys were training. I wasn't getting any training. So then we get the ship out, and the captain says to me, he said, "Get your gear ready because we're shipping out." I said, "Where are we going?" He said, "We're going." And I said, "But I haven't had any training." And he said, "I forgot about you." So they got the teachers, brought us on the aft of the ship, showed me all the jungle training we're supposed to have. Then we made the dry run on Guadalcanal.
I want you to flesh this out a little bit because, I mean, it sounds kind of crazy these days to think about what they're sending you into with no preparation whatsoever. But when your outfit, the 81st Infantry Division, is in Hawaii to train to go to the Pacific, you end up a lifeguard on Waikiki Beach.
Correct.
Didn't have to do any military training at all.
No.
How'd you pull that off?
I was a lifeguard before I was in the service, in the scouting. Then when I got to Marysville, I became a lifeguard in Marysville Pool, training the guys to jump off the high dive, like jumping off of a high ship.
Uh-huh.
And that was my job, is teach a guy doesn't break his neck with a strap from the helmet.
Sure.
And they're jumping from off the high board, which is 20, 30 feet in the air. My job is to teach them. That's all I was doing.
I can't imagine a better Army job than lifeguard on Waikiki Beach.
No, that was the best.
You never had to save the Duke, did you?
No, but I had the pleasure of telling the colonel to get off the beach.
Oh, yeah? How'd that happen?
This girl happened to be a friend of mine in Geneva. When I was on lifeguard, he said, "Hey, Frank," I'm over, and he shook hands. And then he finally says, "How about having lunch with me?" I said, "Sure, great." I didn't know anything about rules and regulations. So after I got off shift at 12 o'clock, I walk over to the Royal Hawaiian Hotel, and he saw me, and he says, "You're a private?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "I can't eat with you." I said, "Okay, goodbye." And I turned around, walked back, kind of teetered me off. So the next afternoon, here he comes down, strutting down in his swimming suit to the NCO's beach. I blow my whistle. I says, "Hey, you're off the wrong beach." And I run the car. He went home and he told my parents about it.
Oh, that's funny. Well, hey, it was the NCO beach. He's got his own beach, right?
Right.
So you're doing this lifeguard stuff, and then the 81st is getting ready to ship out, and you say, "Wait, I don't know what I'm doing."
Right.
So they train you actually on the ship heading over.
Going on a dry run means pretend of war.
Yeah.
So we hit the beach at Guadalcanal.
Because that had already been secured by American forces.
Right.
But you guys do a mock invasion just to practice.
Correct.
So what was your role in that?
I just, with my tank is all.
Uh-huh.
I just went in with my tank, did my job. Then we come back on and the captain says, "Sharpen up your tools." He says, "The real McCoy is coming." So we got ready, and just a few days later, we were hitting the beach.
And what kind of tank was this? How many guys would be on a crew for that tank?
I think it was 7 of us.
And what was your job inside that tank?
At that time, I was handling the ammunition, and then I was on the outside calling in. When we hit the beach the first time, I was outside the tank. We come off the beach, and we have to hit the railroad track, which was built on a mound, to going up to the phosphate plant. So my driver says, "We'll take the high road, and we'll direct Abel Company, Baker Company on our side, be our bodyguards, like."
Mm-hmm.
So we start going up, but as we're going up here like this here, we're a little faster than the jungle going through all that coral rock. So we started to get ahead of them.
Mm.
And then when we got ahead of them, they thought it was Japanese up ahead fighting. They ordered firing for the head squad where we were. And our own troops started firing at us.
Ooh.
It's about that time the airplanes, Japs coming across, and one of them is coming down. You get the machine gun. You could see the dust coming up off of the railroad track. And that's when I jump over the side of the tracks off the tank, maybe 15 or 20 feet down. And two other kids went down with me, one from Abel Company. One was a blonde kid, I remember him. And he landed in front of me. I was in the center, and this other kid on the left side against the tree. I lost my helmet because I was talking on the phone. And I just rubbed my head, and I said, "Oh, God, not in the head. Please don't let me get hit in the head." We hit the bottom of the thing. The kid against the tree got shrapnel in the helmet. He didn't die. The medics picked him up. And I didn't get a scratch on me. And the kid in front of me got a hit in the chest, which killed him outright.
Wow.
The medics were there. And one guy says to me, he said, "God was on your side." I says, "Yep, I'm going to be lived to 103 after that." And that's where the 103 come out.
Well, and you're just 4 years away. So I want everyone to understand what we're talking about here. This is your very first taste of combat.
Right.
The first few minutes and first hour of your combat. This is the landing at Angar.
Angara.
So this is part of the Palau chain. You guys hit a bunch of islands. But your very first taste of combat, you're going in with the tanks. You get out in front. So your own guys are firing at you, and then Japanese planes start strafing you.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you dive off the side of a tank, but right. This is an embankment or something, or
yeah.
You fall a long way.
About 18 feet.
Now that in itself could kill you.
Yeah.
You lose your helmet, and the machine gun bullets are still coming in.
Yeah.
It kills one guy next to you, the other guy gets hit in the helmet.
The bomb hit the front of the tank, and shrapnel hit us all around us.
So one of the Japanese planes bombed the tank, mm-hmm. destroyed the tank.
Right.
Wounded one guy next to you, killed the other guy.
Right.
You don't have a helmet, but you don't have a scratch.
Right.
I'd say that guy was right. I think God was on your side. But how do you handle that at the time?
You're not thinking of anything, but keep going. As soon as the medics got rid of me, I was going back to my tank. They disabled that tank, and then so I had to go to another tank, and yeah, that was a rough day.
Well, yeah, and that sounds like that was just the beginning of the day.
Yeah.
So what happened after that? What was the rest of that day like?
We got up to the trellis as far as the top of the hill, and then we saw the phosphate plant. We didn't know it was there, but then we set camp right there, so watching the phosphate plant. Well, Abel Company and Baker Company surrounded it. We stood guard over top, and as they needed fire, we directed fire. Then that evening come in, and that was the scary part.
Why was that?
You didn't know what was out there. It's all so black.
And this is a brand new experience for you. Never been in combat before. Did you sleep at all that night?
Nobody slept.
Not at all?
No.
What goes through your mind while you're sitting there in the dark?
Hope nobody comes over the top of that thing. You got your gun ready all the time. The coral rock was so hard you couldn't even dig a thing, so we got under our tanks, you know, to hide out.
Yikes.
Too bad, too much.
Well, yeah, you have shared with me that when the war ended, you put it away. I mean, you came home, you got to work. This is not something that you've dwelt upon for the last 70-plus years.
No, but it's coming back.
Well, and I know your recent trip to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Southern Nevada triggered a flood of memories coming back. I'm very thankful you're willing to take us to some of those places today. When Frank said too much, he meant too much was coming back, and it was just too tough to talk about. I think it's a good time to take our first break. When we come back, we're going to hear more about his experiences in the invasion of Angar Island. And if you want to get an even more thorough picture, go to hometownheroesradio.com because I have a film the War Department shot with the 81st Infantry Division on Angar in 1944. You'll see the action that Frank's describing, and I think you'll better understand why it's so difficult to talk about. We're going to hear about the time he says he would have been dead if he had been in his usual spot in his tank. And we'll also hear how he met the young lady who would become his wife. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's conversation with 99-year-old Frank Costa of Las Vegas. Yes, I did say 99. He's originally from Geneva, New York, in the beautiful Finger Lakes region in the center of the state. I want to thank Belinda Morse of Honor Flight Southern Nevada for letting me know about Frank, one of 3 brothers who all served our country during World War II. Frank was in the Pacific with the Wildcats of the 81st Infantry Division. He took part in the invasion and capture of Angar Island in the Palaus in September of 1944, moving on from there to relieve the 1st Marine Division on Peleliu. There was mop-up duty on the island of Leyte in the Philippines before training for the planned invasion of Japan, and eventually occupation duty right after the Japanese surrender. But those tense, dangerous weeks on Angar, was that the most intense action you ever experienced?
They all seemed the same to me. You're on the ground, you're going ahead, and you're going to see how far you can get without getting hit, I guess.
And when you said initially with this tank, you're handling ammunition, what does that mean? You're grabbing it and handing it to someone else to load it?
When ammunition comes, there's so many powder bags.
Right.
They'll say for 3, 4, how many powder bags? Say it says 3. So you put 3 powder bags and break the other, throw the other one away. Then that shell is only going to go so far.
Mm-hmm.
If you want 4, then you put 4, and then it'll go that much further. And then we lost our tank in second or third day. We're going through Buddy Gulch. as we were around the corner, cut in the canyon, in the mountain, as we took the corner, the Japanese had set up the gun on the far end. They caught our tank right in the turret, which disabled our turret. You couldn't turn it, and brought up on edge, disabled our tank. We were stuck there.
Where were you when the tank was hit?
I was outside. Lucky. Nobody got killed, but Horace Buck got a shell through his leg. The two drivers got hit in the back of the head. When a shell went in, hit the back side of the inside the tank, and the shrapnel hit the back of their neck.
So if you had been in the tank for that, you probably would
have
got
dead.
Some. You'd have been dead.
Yeah, I've been dead because the shell hit where I was loading the gun.
And how recently had you transitioned from that job?
I was gone maybe 5 minutes.
You'd been in the tank 5 minutes before?
Yeah.
Why did you go outside?
Yeah, I really don't remember. All I remember, they opened the turret and says, do this. And I went out to do it, and next thing I know, kawang.
So 5 minutes. If you hadn't left that tank, if you'd been still in there 5 minutes later.
Again, I'd have been gone.
But so then you see this. Your buddies are all hurt. Your tank is disabled. You can't move. So what'd you guys do?
We stayed there protecting what we could. Then a General Sherman tank come up from, I think it was the Marine Corps, I'm not sure. Bill Riley from my hometown was on that tank. He hollered, get that thing out of the way. And they put the chain and dragged our tank out. Then I found out Bill was on that tank.
What a small world.
Small world.
You're about as far from Geneva, New York as you can be.
That was it, and he moved on, and I moved on.
Were you scared?
Was I scared? I'd be lying if I said no. I was, as they would put S's. Yes, I was scared.
How did you keep going? How did you deal with that? I mean, you've just described.
Your buddies really will keep you going.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. You got together with this, Paul, do you hear that? Yeah, I heard that. Okay, I'll watch this side, you watch that side. I mean, you were close, you're depending on each other.
Mm-hmm.
So, scared is not the word for it. It's just beat. I don't know how to describe it. But if I was to stand up on a thing, I'd be so shaking. Whatever was with me, you'd be shaking with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were all scared.
And how did you process losing guys around you, seeing guys killed right next to you?
I don't know how to explain that one. You just wish them luck when they went by you. That's about all of it. The ones that went down, there's nothing much you could do with them. I don't want to talk about that.
I guess the question that comes to mind in light of that is, did you ever feel like maybe I'm next?
Yes, more than once.
Think about your family back home?
I think you're thinking of everything back east.
Do you ever get any mail from them while you were over there?
Mail every day. Every day they delivered mail, I got mail.
From Mom?
Mom. My sister wrote every single day.
Wow.
And Lena wrote every day.
Well, we didn't cover that. So Lena is your wife of 69 years. You just lost her a couple years ago. So you guys knew each other before you went overseas.
Yeah, I met her at the first dance in Marysville. I was at the barracks. I was up on the second floor writing a home letter to my mother. And the girls from the city came in on dance night. It was on a Wednesday night. Lena walked in the door, and I'm at the far end of that dance hall. And I spotted her. Closed the letter. I said, Mom, somebody just walked in. I want to meet. Talk to you later.
You wrote that in the letter?
Mm-hmm. And I closed the letter. I walked down the side of the balcony, cut down the stairway. The girls went up the stairway that way to the room to take the coats off. Then they would come down the stairs, and the guys on this side came down the stairs, and they met in the bottom. That was a dance partner. I go down, and I 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 22. And I count 22 of mine. You can go, wait a minute, this way, that way. I got 22, and they're going down. Got as far as 8. She's 8th, and I'm 8. Just then a bunch of non-coms come in. They take the next 10 or 12 girls.
Oh.
I couldn't find her. Lena being short, 4'11", they took her, and she disappeared. She's here, and the crowd's up here.
You can't find her because she's too little, sure.
So I'm looking around, and finding Leo Kaufman, a little Jewish friend of mine from Connecticut. And Leo Kaufman come up to me and said, Frank, I met somebody I knew you'd like to meet. Leo, I'm not looking for her. I got somebody I want to meet, and I can't find her. He said, oh, there she is sitting over at that table over there. I look, that's the girl I'm looking for. That's how I met her. He introduced me to her, and I asked her for the dance. She had the dance. All her dances were taken.
Mm-hmm.
So when the tag dance came along, I tagged. I know sooner tag somebody tagged me back. So I went over to Leo. I says, get the gang and keep the guys off me. I want to dance with her. So he got four or five of the fellas, and they danced around her, and I got dancing. That's how I got to meet her.
That was quite an effort.
It was an effort. I asked her last name. She wouldn't give me her last name. And she says, it starts with a Z. I said, just a minute, I'll be right back. So I went around the corner and to the telephone booth. Looked in the telephone, there was only four Z's. So I got one with John and one with Gaetano. So I went back, your name, it starts with a Z. It wouldn't be Zanoni, would it? How did you find that out? I said, little birdie told me. I said, did your father Gaetano or John? And she said, you know more than I thought you did. She said, Gaetano's my dad. So then I said, okay, after got a couple of dances, and I asked if I could have a date coming up. I had to go to Grass Valley. No bus, no train, no nothing going to Grass Valley, 30 miles away.
Uh-huh. Hitchhiked it?
I had to hitchhike it.
Just to get a date.
And then at midnight, curfew.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh is right. I didn't know anything about it. So when I was at the USO there, Mrs. Morton says, where are you going to stay tonight? I said, I don't know. I'm going to have to get a place. She says, stay at my place tonight. And Spaghetti, a kid from Massachusetts, and I got to stay at her place. And the next morning, trying to get a bus out, nothing out. You had to get on the corner. But people were nice. We got a ride right away. So that's how I got to meet Lena.
What was it about her that made her so desirable to you that you had to pursue her to that extent?
Well, I don't know. Just looked, and that's the woman I want.
But then you had to leave. Did you have an idea before you left that this might be the one you're going to marry someday?
I was pretty sure, but I didn't tell her that. I didn't want to get married before I left, and I didn't want to be engaged before I left. I said, if anything happened, I don't want her to have me hanging over her.
Uh-huh.
So my mother caught on right away.
Well, you had written in the letter.
I said, somebody walked in. But when I said, I'm going to California, she knew right away.
Oh, after the war. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But so when you go overseas, she was writing you nonstop.
Yeah. I wrote every single day.
You guys still have any of those letters?
Got a box that long.
How about that? When you're overseas, the guy next to you has just been killed. You've almost been killed. You finally have a chance to rest, and you open up a letter from that girl back home. What did that mean to you?
That builds you right up. I meant everything. I got something to go home to. She kept me alive, I guess. I have Beauchel, couldn't read or write. Saw me with a pile of letters. He says, I wish I could get a letter from home. I said, why don't you write her a letter? He said, I can't write. I said, you can't write? No, he was from Oklahoma or Alabama or someplace. So I said, I'll write you a letter. So I put in care of the post office. Please read this for him. I put right on the letter. About a week later, Beauchel comes back to me with a letter mailed to him. He brings it to me to read to him.
Uh-huh.
And the postmistress thought it was a good gesture for me to take my time to write to somebody that couldn't read or write.
And wow.
So I wrote three or four letters for Beauchel. And when he got out of the service, I understand my captain sent him to school, made him go to school, took care of him.
Wow.
I don't think I got a member of my company left. I think they're all gone.
Mm.
We used to have reunions.
Uh-huh.
I missed every one of them. Something always came up. Then in the last letter, last meeting, Jim Snyder passed away, and his wife wrote and says, I don't think we have any more. Jim is gone. And I think, Frank, you're about the only one from the canning company left. So I don't know. I don't have any high school classmates. I don't have any army classmates. My job, all the salesmen are gone, all died.
Well, just wait till you're 103.
I won't have anybody left.
You told me about Beauchel, and I'm sure that touches a lot of people to hear that seemingly little thing that you were able to do for him that meant so much. What else can you tell me about the guys that you served with and what you guys did for each other over there?
You were always doing something for each other. If you didn't feel good, I'd take over your job for you. We wouldn't send you to sick bay. We wanted you with us. It was just one happy group. We worked with each other. We looked out for each other. And they're all gone. Hmm.
As far as the time you spent in the Pacific, you started Angar. You moved through this Palau chain. Peleliu was one of the major battles. There are a lot of smaller ones. You end up in the Philippines later on at Leyte. Throughout all that time, what was the most difficult thing for you to deal with?
I guess losing a buddy. Too much is coming back. I had to quit.
Sure. you know, I'm sure you can look back on a lot of moments where it could have been you. And those are individually for you, but there are some big picture things that happened too that maybe were the difference between you living or dying. You guys originally were scheduled to take part in the invasion of Iwo Jima.
Yeah.
What happened?
That's when we broke out with dysentery. Somebody didn't wash out the dishes and left the soapy. And just broke out of the whole ship. So they brought us to the Philippines and in 98 took our place on Iwo Jima.
So you guys were actually on the ship headed to Iwo Jima.
We were and the Admiral's heading that way.
So everybody got sick.
The captain and I are the only ones who weren't sick.
What was your secret to not getting sick?
I don't know. I guess I didn't eat what they ate. My captain said to me, "You're coming with me, Frank. We're going off shore." All the guys were sent ashore, and the Navy guys who weren't sick were cleaning up the deck. And he says, "You're not staying here and cleaning them up. You're going with me."
But that outbreak of dysentery, as miserable as it was for those affected, probably saved a lot of lives. Maybe yours, too.
Yes. I often wondered about that.
And then another twist that I guess you might look at and say, hey, maybe that saved my life, would be Truman's decision to drop those bombs?
I'm sure it is.
Because you guys were training to invade Japan, right?
Yeah. We were supposed to have Iwo Jima be stand-in for Japan, but we never made it. So after he dropped the bomb, we were the first troops to land in Japan.
Where'd you come ashore?
Aomori.
What'd you see?
When we got there, it was about 30 degrees below zero. I didn't have any heavy coat on. I just had a regular... I was picked out of the hills to be the forward OP. And when I got there, I had nothing. Company A captain says, "Where's your jacket, soldier?" They picked me out of the mountains and put me in the ship. So he got a blanket for me. So I wore a blanket instead of a jacket. We walked into town. We walked on each side of the street. 50 feet apart, be here, alternate. And as we walked down the street, nobody was on the street but the police. And when we come up to them, they put their hands behind their back, bowed their back to us. They were ashamed. And we walked through downtown. We marched it to the airport, and then we had to sleep on the ground because the barracks were all full of lice and hay. And we slept on the ground in the runway.
Out in the open when it's that cold. I guess upstate New York has nothing on that, huh?
No, it didn't.
How long were you there in Japan?
I got there in November, and we left there in February.
During that time, did you have much interaction with Japanese people?
Yeah, they turned out to be pretty nice. I was kind of leery at first, and then I got a TDY, sent on temporary duty. So they sent me to Tokyo. So they sent me there for a three-day weekend, and that's when I got the... talked to a lot of the Japanese people, and they weren't too bad to talk to, and they were ashamed of what they've done.
How about just as far as witnessing the destruction, the way some of these places were decimated? Did that make an impression on you?
In the part of Japan where I was, there was no destruction at all. But where the bomb was dropped was just 100 miles, I'd say, from where we were.
Gotcha. I was referring to Tokyo, where the firebombing, from what I've seen and read and heard, was so widespread, the destruction was just overwhelming. Time for another break, but we're going to hear what Frank experienced on his honor flight to Washington, D.C., including a moment that wasn't planned, but added even more emotion to his wreath-laying at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And remember when Frank was describing that scene in Angar's Bloody Gulch when his tank was hit and it was blocking the other tanks from getting through? If you go to hometownheroesradio.com and pull up that War Department film recorded on Angar in 1944, you're going to see a very similar scenario. And whether it's Frank's tank or not, you'll see exactly what he was talking about and what he was dealing with. And maybe you'll imagine what in the world you would have done if you were in that situation. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is Frank Costa, 99 years old, originally from Geneva, New York, where his Italian immigrant father sat his three boys down after America was drawn into World War II and made it very clear where their allegiance was to be. All three Costa boys would serve in the U.S. Armed Forces during World War II. All three of them came home. And Frank says the memories he's sharing today were completely buried for the last 7 decades. We've heard about his close calls on Angar Island, his first action in the Pacific with the 81st Infantry Division. Most of us will never experience anything like it. And I think it helps the rest of us really digest it when we realize how powerful the emotions can be all these years later. So I'm really grateful for Frank's transparency and candor today.
I don't want to skip over anything. You told us a couple of the close calls early on in your time in the service. Are there some other things that you still remember where it could have been you and almost was you?
Well, I guess it was. I don't think one was any more than the other, because your main thing was to see that you stayed alive.
I just wondered if there are any other examples you wanted to share that your family may or may not have heard that might leave an impression on them to know what Dad and Grandpa and Great-Grandpa has been through.
Nobody knows what I went through. This is the first time I've ever talked about it. When I left Geneva, I left all my war stories back there. I didn't say nothing. My brother didn't even know what grade I was when I graduated, when I left the service. Mm. He just knew I was in the Army.
And here we talked about your two brothers. Your older brother was involved in Normandy and the Bulge, all the big stuff in Europe. Your younger brother's in the Navy. So you all three had these experiences. You all three come home. And the three of you never traded stories.
Nope.
Not at all.
My brother John would not say boo. My sister says, you mentioned the war, and my brother would blow his top. Mm. Don't talk about the war to me. He went through hell. He went through the more than my brother, other brother and I put together.
And you know that just from knowing the outfit he was in and the battles he went through.
He was in the 4th Army.
Not because he actually told you any stories.
He didn't say anything. They sent a telegram to my mother. He was missing in action. Next day says, mistaken identity. Next day, killed in action. Next day, mistaken identity.
Wow.
3 telegrams. What do you think the mothers are going through?
Yeah, seriously. Well, speaking of, what was it like to come home and see your mom and dad and sister again?
I walked out of Fort Dix with my duffel bag, got on a bus, arrived home, walked home. That was it. I didn't know fanfare.
Just something tells me your mom gave you a little hug when you got when you showed up. There's a question for you, Frank. I married an Italian girl whose grandma was quite a cook, and I know how that gets passed down, those family recipes. All that time in the Pacific where you're eating out of a can or out of the jungle, did you ever think about a home-cooked meal from Mama?
More than once. I've said more today than I've said in 70 years.
Wow. Well, it's a privilege to be here and listen to a little bit of it. After you had that reunion with your family in upstate New York, as you told us, you put the war behind. You headed to California because you had to go see that girl that you had worked so hard to meet at the dance in Marysville. Did Lena know you were coming?
Yeah, I called her.
How long did you wait before you put that ring on her finger?
I got there in May and married in August.
She didn't make you work too hard? She didn't say no?
No. She didn't hesitate.
You know, I know this isn't easy to talk to you, and I appreciate you and your candor in telling me when it's stuff that's too difficult for you to go there. But have you ever had the thought, as you approach your 100th birthday, that if that bomb that killed the guy next to you and wounded the other guy next to you, if that would have gotten you, some of those other close calls you described, if you had still been in the tank 5 minutes later when it got hit, that if you didn't survive all that, you never would have made it back to marry Lena, that your sons and your grandsons and your great-grandsons would have never been born?
That's right. I never thought of that.
How do you make sense of that?
I was a positive person. I always look on the positive side.
And you told us you put the war away. So it was never something you and Lena talked about, never something you talked about with your sons. But now, here just recently, you go to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Southern Nevada. You get to see that World War II memorial that honors all 16 million of you, including the three Costa boys who served our country, but specifically those 406,000 Americans who didn't come home. What did you think about while you were at that memorial?
Thank God it's over with.
Were there any surprises for you on that trip?
Yes. Getting the honor of putting the wreath on the unknown soldier's tomb, I had no idea I was going to be asked.
When did they ask you?
The night before.
Uh-huh.
It says to Frank, he says, you got the honor of putting the wreath in the grave. I said, I can't do that. I can't walk up there. And he says, don't worry. He says, it's all taken care of. We got somebody to push you up. And so lucky, one of the veterans of my roommate had fought in Okinawa. He was my pusher. And then there was a nurse, I think 40 years in the service. She also came up. That's when everything opened up again.
Well, yeah, so I want our listeners to hear this. You've shared with me this story. I think they'll be touched by it too. So when you get there to Arlington National Cemetery and you make your way to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, you're watching that incredible display of precision of that guard detail and that eternal patrol that happens there in front of it. And it wasn't raining when you got there, right?
Well, it had been raining.
But it stopped.
It stopped.
So tell everybody what happened.
When we got up there, they gave us ponchos, raincoats and everything, and said it might be raining a little bit. So just as we got there, it seemed like it stopped completely. They put us on the end of their runway, and when they gave us the signal to go, we started going, started to sprinkle a little bit. We walked up so many paces, turned right to go to the tomb, and a little more rain, we got up, pushed the wreath to the guard. The guard picked it up on the rack. Just as he puts it on the rack, cloud opened. All the rain came down. It was a thunderstorm-like. And we moved back, and just then one of the guys that was pushing me says, God is crying. And that's when I broke it. So we moved back a little bit, and then they started playing taps. And while they're playing taps, it started to get harder and harder. And so I'm facing the tomb, and the bugler between me and the tomb of the unknown soldier. And all I can think of, that guy is right. He's crying.
What's the most meaningful thing that you got out of that honor flight experience?
How lucky I was, I guess. I was really happy that I think every veteran should get the goal. Every one of them should see this.
You told us how many letters you got from Lena and from your family in upstate New York while you were overseas. Did you get any mail on that?
I had a laugh on that one. They said mail call. I said, who's going to write me a mail call? So they get up on the bus, and they start calling these different names out. Everybody had maybe two or three little envelopes. Then they come to my name. I come up two or three inches thick. I said, I thought it was a joke. And so I picked it up and thanked them for it. And I started opening it. I opened up, and I found a package of powdered egg. I found a fork and spoon. So Terry came up to me and she says, I got a story to tell you about that. I said, what happened? She says, whoever it was sent you this package, when he got to the security, they took the can of Spam and a can of beans and the knife and the pick out of your package.
They were trying to really give you a taste of 1945 again.
Right.
But TSA got the better of that ration package.
They got the beans and the Pam. So Larry's got all the letters on. They wanted to read them. I was never so surprised in my life. Mail call. I guess that's a highlight of the trip.
Well, what I hear a lot from veterans, well, there's a few things. Sometimes if they have a police escort in Washington, they really love that.
Yeah, they did. That was good.
Makes you feel like a king, right? They tell me about the mail call and then the reception when they land back at the airport. And a lot of them say they didn't think anybody cared, and now they realize people do. And it sounds like for you, maybe it's more than realizing that other people value what you did, but maybe being reminded yourself what you went through and how significant it was? Because this is really something you haven't thought about for a long time.
No, I never thought about it.
So what are you most proud of now at 99 years old?
I guess listening to my dad.
When he told you you're an American.
I think that was it.
Well, if there's anything else that you want to share, I want you to have that opportunity, but I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for taking us places that we couldn't go without you.
Yeah, all I can say is you're welcome, but I just still can't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think it'd be this hard.
Well, I know it took courage to go, and it took courage to keep going, and I appreciate the courage that you've shown in going back there and talking about it as much as you have. I have one last question for you. You're almost 100 years old. As you said, you're probably the last guy from your company. There aren't a whole lot of World War II veterans in general left, and most of us alive today didn't live through that time. So when you think about your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids, what do all of us need to know about you and those 16 million Americans in uniform in World War II?
I don't know how to answer that.
Do you feel like you accomplished something significant?
Yes, I think I did. I didn't realize it at the time. I've gone through life without thinking about the war period. I've gone through 75 years after the war, and then all of a sudden I'm talking about the war. I thought it was going to be easy. I didn't realize that things would pop up like that.
Yeah. Maybe there'll be a day where you're sitting with your kids and it's a little easier to talk about.
No, from now on, I'll probably be talking about some. They'll be asking questions.
Good. Gives them some perspective. You know, the rest of us have never been through anything like what you went through. We don't even understand.
All I got to be is thankful I'm alive.
Has your little brother been on an honor flight yet?
No, my older brother was.
He was before he passed?
John.
Sam's the other one?
Sam hasn't made it yet.
Where's Sam live?
In Geneva.
Well, he's only 97, so if a 99-year-old can do it, I know he can too. And we'll make sure to connect him with the volunteers who are putting together honor flights from Rochester and Syracuse, since Geneva and those beautiful Finger Lakes are kind of right between the two. Wherever you're listening today, there's most likely an Honor Flight hub near you. You can find a listing and a map of them at honorflight.org. And remember, there's absolutely no cost to the veteran for this trip to Washington, D.C. and so many monuments and destinations, like Arlington National Cemetery, where Frank was able to lay that wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. But the impetus, of course, is getting World War II veterans to the National World War II Memorial. It wasn't completed until 2004. Thanks to $190 million of private donations, mostly from World War II veterans themselves. And most of them never got to see it. Most World War II veterans were long gone by the time it was finished, and those who remain often have a difficult time getting there on their own. But the Honor Flight Network makes it possible, as Honor Flight Southern Nevada did for Frank. Anything else you want to say about that, Frank?
I wish everybody had a chance to see it, all the veterans. It's an eye-opener. The reception at that airport, though, that was out of this world. How did they know anything about me, and all of a sudden they knew all about me? Didn't even know who I was, and they were cheering for me.
Makes you feel like you're somebody, doesn't it?
Yeah. How do they know that about me?
Well, they know a whole lot more about you now, and hopefully those conversations will continue with your family so they can learn even more about what you did and what you had to endure during World War II. That is Frank Costa, 99 years old, of Las Vegas, Nevada, You'll find some photos from his trip to Washington, D.C. at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You'll also find a link to the Honor Flight Network so you can look into signing up the veteran in your life. And don't forget about that War Department film of the 81st Infantry Division on Angar Island. It really is a time machine. It'll take you right there. Frank's first action back in 1944. Thanks so much for spending this hour with us today here on Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.